A list of stories outlined in the memo dated 10/24/1996 regarding Jack Kemp. The purpose of dictating his recollections is background for Gideon as well as biographical material that we need to create the making of the pop. The first section is the road to meeting Kemp and kind of where I was in 1988. The partners had sold the firm in 1986, which is a whole other story. But what happened when they sold the firm is we agreed, and I agreed with Nick Brady, that I would sign a 2-year non-compete. And my interpretation of that non-compete is it locked me into 2 annual compensation packages and a bonus package when the non-compete was over that pretty much capped my salary. And the request of the partners at that time was, since I was responsible and probably controlled the vast majority of the income and revenues in the municipal department, to delegate and teach the rest of the department how to do the business. It's interesting that I had a partner in municipal, his name is Ken Schmidt, and some others, and my strategy in 1986, after sort of realizing what the politics, small p of the situation was that I was exhausted from doing what it took to become a partner. I also wanted to get a divorce, which was another exhausting thing. I needed time. I just found out from my dentist of all people that all the dental work I'd had over the last 10 years when I've been in New York, or 8 years when I've been in New York, was wrong and had to be redone. So I had $12,000 of dental work to do, which was extremely painful, blah, 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 blah. So I decided what I would do is no matter how hard I worked or how much money I made for the firm, I could never increase my compensation. And in fact, the less I worked and the more I let everyone else steal all my business, without me admitting that I knew that that's what was going on, what I could do is radically increase my income per hour by simply working much less hard. And, you know, what everybody said is, we want you to be a salesman, we want you to, you know, develop all your marketing skills, all this kind of to get me to turn over the power. And so I said, great, you know, let me be a salesman. And what I did was I completely refashioned my time to stop getting business and ensuring that we were maximizing profits within the department. And I used all my time to attend to my personal needs. And by 1988, I was the little wife of Riley. I had 2 boxes at Lincoln Center for the opera paid for by the firm. I had a database of every restaurant of 150 of the restaurants in New York. I wanted to try was the 100 that I loved, where I could sort it in my sort of, you know, laptop I carried around with me. I could sort it by actually I had it in my daybook. I could sort it by types of restaurants in the neighborhood. So, you know, you and I could be in Tribeca and we'd say, well, let's do Italian in Tribeca, and boom, I could have a list of the 3 great restaurants I wanted to try. 150 restaurants in a year, it was incredible. I was going to the gym for 3 hours a day, going to pumping iron. And I had a huge personal and corporate account with Westport Car Service. I had a car and a limo taking me everywhere. So I'd get up in the morning, go jog in the park, then come home, shower, and have a car pick me up and take me to work. It's kind of funny, you think you could jog to work. And I had a corporate account canvas, and which was right across from the firm, and I'd get in the morning and just go over to canvas and have my hair and nails done. And, you know, my nails were like 8 feet long, and my hair was long and beautiful. And so in terms of personal appearance and grooming, you know, I was great. And I felt great. I had my $12,000 of dental work done, which was horrible, but I got all that done. And And, you know, I had so much perspective, and my partners would do the most godless and lawless things. And I was just, like, totally gone. The whole subject, I could just manage and handle myself very well, no matter what they were doing. And it was funny, by the end of 1988, after I successfully let them steal all the systems, they finally realized that I was taking out to dinner every night a new important person and charging it to the firm anytime their business was resulting. I could say the guys, on the basement. Isn't that what you wanted? That was fun. Anyway, so, but meantime, Wall Street became more and more speculative. Nick went down in September 1988 and attempted to do the Treasury deal with the Reagan administration. And we all knew that George Bush was down there just holding the fort, trying to keep the thing going before the election. And then Ed Pelton was anything that was going to happen. And it was that fall in winter that the Campos deal happened. Now, I knew as soon as Nick left the firm, I was going to have to get out of there. But I would try and do whatever I could while I was there, because I promised him that I would do the right thing by the firm. I would try and teach them what I knew about what the opportunities were, what the risks. Because no matter how genial they were, part of me still felt like it was my firm, and as long as I'm going to sit here and take a paycheck, I should do the right thing by the shareholders, just the way I feel. So, I forget the exact date, but I walked into the boardroom. We did banking meetings, every morning most of us were in a banking meeting, local bank. And I walked into one of the banking meetings, and Steve Spencer gave a presentation about how we wanted to come in behind Kurt's boss and do the Campo deal. And lo and behold, the Campo deal was the Campo Federated deal. And Spencer and the LBM group were just incredibly excited about it. And they sat there and they gave their presentation. And it was the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. They had a sources and uses of funds statement. And in the sources of funds, there was $150 million of present value savings that middle management was going to get by making the operation more efficient over the next 15 years. And in the uses of statement, there was $220 million that the investment bankers and lawyers and senior management were going to take out up front, which meant middle managers were supposed to pay and get more revenues and less expenses for the next 15 years. And 100% of their hard work, 150% of their hard work would go to paying a bunch of swingers to get money out up front. And I said, this doesn't work. If it's in a business, the middle management's got to work hard, and they've got to have what it takes to do it, and they got to care, and they got to get incentives. They got to get upside for what they're doing, not the absence of downside. Finally, Steve Fenster looked at me like I was a stupid girl, couldn't I know how the game was played. And he said, Austin, what do we care? We'll have our money out in December. Which means we were going to use bridge financing from our parent travelers to finance the deal. And then do a bond deal in December where we charge huge underwriting fees. Our total fees on all of these are going to be $18 million, and the travelers would be out in December. And I said to him, Steve, we may be out, but our bond buyers will not be. We're going to sell this paper to, buyers or customer of the firm. And he just looked at me like I was an idiot. Like I didn't get it. And that's when I realized, I gotta get out of here before this goes down, because this is gonna turn my business. And I walked downstairs, and I said to Russ Davis, how'd you like to go to Washington? And he said, why? And I said, I think it's gonna be a big mess. Because I knew there was a cleanup from the SNL scandal. And, but if the LBO stuff was going to get this crazy, then I didn't understand at the time that a lot of it was the junk bonds that everybody was buying, CBS and all these insurance companies. a float, but I figured maybe something was up. So I just interrupted. It's going to be a big cleanup today. And it's a good time to go to Washington. Now, what I knew is I wanted to go to Washington because I wanted to learn how all the money works. And I pretty much exhausted, I felt, what I could learn on Wall Street without kind of understanding how the money was rigged culturally or politically, or how cultural values translated into political ignorance translated into fucking up the market. So then the question became, how do you go to Washington? Now, it's interesting. I had done a lot of good work in the campaign. I sold 3 tables to the George Bush dinner right after his first big loss in primaries. I didn't know if he was going to answer or whatever the loss is. Or when, I guess it was, the word was he was going to lose New Hampshire and no one would help Jonathan, and I got 3 more tables. But I raised a ton of money and worked hard and did a certain speakers, and I've done 84. Helped raise money on the county and state and the times and places that nobody wanted to do it. And I had raised money. I was I forget what it is, the presidential whatever, but you can use $10,000. And in fact, one of the great stories in circulating was the last one was that Peter Turpin, like, kept telling me that, you know, that I had to be the president for the president of the Bush, and I was trying to get in front of Bush, and because they had all this stuff about advising Bush about men and professional women. And Peter's theory was that, you know, I could make a name for myself in that group. I wasn't that excited about it, but Peter taught me to come down here in Washington for $10,000 over and arranged for me to sit next to the president. And Bill Brock's wife was on the other side of me and had a very low-cut dress. And the president wouldn't talk to me because the only thing he's going to talk to Bill Brock like, and the whole time all he did was stare at me. So the next day, I'm sitting at my office back in New York, and Brady calls up and says, you know, I hear that your conversation is nowhere interesting. This is Brock's dead. I said, thanks. Clearly, that must have been before September. Anyway, so the question was, we're going to go to Washington, and then go to Washington, blah, 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 blah. Well, I started to interview for jobs that other firms on Wall Street are not going to be contracted with the company in the 1988, 1989. And so the headhunters all started to call, and I started to talk to, I tried to talk to Bill and Reese about the amazing refactioning, how they were doing the business to reposition themselves in the future, and that kind of went absolutely nowhere. Berkman came back to me with an idea for me to play a role in marketing the LBO paper that was just dangerous. You know, just reflecting for not understanding kind of how I did something. They used to believe that I could sell anything to anybody, and what they didn't understand is I could sell anything to anybody, but I really truly believed it. Now, all my deals were, all my real estate deals that I was saying before, and a lot of money on the phone were extremely novel and budgetary. I didn't think they were high risk. I was, you know, my shtick was taking something out of something unfeasible and very risky, and making it feasible and not risky at all. You locked in the deal. The concept was you locked in the deal at the risk level where the world price is, and figured out how to get the risk way down, and that theoretically was the profit rate. Anyway, so the question was, I had to start interviewing in Washington. get her driver's license after this. And all this kind of stuff is coming around. Anyway, the question was, how was I going to get to do this? Well, Craig Fuller was running the transition team with Tim Weber, which you were. And so I had Craig looking out for a job, and the question for me was, you know, I never had any experience in Washington, and so they were loathing me at the top of the pile, because they don't like somebody in the number one or number two spots in the cabin, unless they know they're wearing their shoes in Washington. So the question is, you know, what do you do with them? Anyway, I get a call from somebody in Fuller's office saying, you know, it was right during the transition. Darling, you got a big, big problem. And I said, what's that? So I said, what's that? And they said, Nick Brady just blackballed you. I said, are you kidding? I said, believe me. Never touched Nick Brady for anything in my life just about. You know, I assure you, never given it. But I couldn't believe he blackballed me. And my understanding of the story is, Baker, Dorman, Brady, Ben, Craig, some of the other senior guys who were sorting out who was going to be the captain. So apparently, they were trying to, every time Craig came up with a woman, they all killed them. They all just did that in and out, or, you know, to Carly Hills and, you know, everybody. So finally, Craig says, look, guys, I'm under strict orders that there will be women in the cabin. Now, you just vetoed all the women on the A team. So Brady says, well, let's look at the B team. Who's number one on the B team? And Craig says, exasperated, or exasperated. Well, you know, number one on the B team, Nick, number one on the B team is Austin Finn. And Nick was a real big cadet said, well, how do you know about Austin Finn? And Craig, what do you mean, how do I know about Austin Finn? Everybody knows Austin Finn. Austin Finn worked in the 84 campaign. She worked in the NBA campaign. She raised a ton of money. Everybody knows her. And Brady says, Austin Finn may not work in Bush administration. And Craig says, are you serious? He says, absolutely. Austin Finn may not work in Bush administration. So the person calls me and says, you've been blackballed. You cannot have a job in the Bush administration. Brady is completely blackballed you. That's interesting. I never used Brady or my connection to Brady to do anything in the Republican campaign in 84 and 88. In fact, I was at the convention as a delegate from New York, and I walked up to Nick on the delegate floor, and he says, what are you doing here? I said, I'm a delegate, Nick. You're not the only delegate doing Brady. So I've never been so angry in my life. I mean, it's fine. I don't ask you for anything. You don't do anything. But it's another thing to blackball me. So I pick up the phone and I call Chief Stanley, Chief Assistant. And I said, Nick, I'm Chief Stanley Smith. I said, I don't care if he's the goddamn Secretary of the Treasury. I want to talk to him. I want to talk to him right now. In 11 years, she had never heard me say anything like that. I'd always said, here's what I need from Nick. You know, I don't, you know, he can call me back. Or, you know, I was always very, very hyperceptive when I first came to the show. So he says, oh my goodness, let me put him on. So he picked up the phone, and this is approximately an hour or two after he left the meeting. And I said, pardon the expression, because this is, I'm not saying it's a violation of my faith. I said, who the fuck do you think you are? Who the fuck do you think you are, Mr. Secretary of the Treasury? You blackball me, you son of a bitch. What do you think you're doing? And he said, how do you know? And I said, Nick, you'd be amazed what I know. Just because you don't know what I know doesn't mean I don't know an incredible amount about what you do and what you say and where you go. And I said, you know, so far I've been a good guy, but it just stopped. And I said, how dare you fucking blackball me? And he said, I promised Ed Budd, when I sold the firm to Travelers, that I wouldn't raid the firm and bring everybody down here. And he said, you're infamous as my protege. If you come down, I will violate my word to Ed Budd. And I said, listen, you goddamn fucking space cadet. I have an offer from Bankers Trust, and I'm negotiating $1 million sign-up bonus to go to Bankers Trust and take hundreds of millions of dollars in municipal business with me, which I think will not make it, but of Travelers very happy. That will not be good at a multiple of 10 times for Ed Budd's stock price. And Brady says, oh, shit. I said, no. Oh, shit, Jack. I said, you know, is there anything else you want to do for Ed Budd today? And he said, oh no, what am I going to do? I've already blackballed you. And I said, Chicken Little is going to fix it herself, and if you fuck it up again, I'll kill you. And then I hung up. I was very mad, even to this day. It doesn't bother me that Brady's one of the most ruthless people I ever met in my life. What bothers me is that he's such a space cadet. God. Story. I just looked back. Ed Budd was the chairman of Travelers. And during the conversation, Brady said, well, why can't you work at Dylan Reed? And I said, Nick, I'm a Brady person, which means with Berkeley, my life expectancy is like 10 seconds. All the Brady people have to leave or he's going to kill us. So the only way we can be safe in our careers to get out as quickly as possible. And he said, well, Berkeley wouldn't do that. And I said, are you, Nick, you? I wanted to say, make it a stupid question that I ever met. But I said, listen, I'm dead meat under Berkeley, and I have to get out, or he's going to, you know, I get a job where he's going to, like, still mess up my reputation and career. You know, I can't get $1 million sign-up bonus, so I got to get out first. And it's a matter of going to Washington, which is what I want to do, or, you know, going someplace else. And if I can't get a job in Washington, I'm going someplace else. I'm going to take the whole Dylan Reed business. Because I've done everything I possibly can to help those fine young men steal it and institutional all of it without me. But, you know, frankly, him does such a great job despite everything I've done. So, you know, it's the law of the jungle, man. Anyway, so, needless to say, I called Craig Fuller back and I said, who hates Nick Brady more than anybody?